This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, or whatever app or platform you prefer, and rate and review us on wherever that is. So imagine it's sometime in the near future, not so far in the future that you're not still putting together flat-packed furniture, but you realize you need to drive some screws into the bookcase or whatever it is you're building and kind of getting pissed off at. And instead of rummaging through your garage or basement for your goddamned electric screwdriver, you tap out rent a drill on your smartphone app. A few minutes later, a package arrives at your door, contains a drill, you drive the screws, you put the drill back in front of your door, and somebody, something, somehow takes it away. Total time, 10 minutes, total cost to you, $2.50. That's a scenario from Tomorrow 3.0, a new book by economist and political scientist Michael Munger. Subtitled Transaction Costs and the Sharing Economy, it takes a long, detailed, nuanced look at what the Duke University professor says is the third great economic revolution in world history, a revolution that is already underway. Michael Munger, welcome to the Reason Podcast.
It's great to be on your show.
Thank you. I think you have been once before, or somehow. Let's not get lost in the burnt out ends of misty memories. But before we get to the book, which is phenomenal, except for the cover, and I want to talk with you about
except
that.
We're gonna fight.
Next okay, time I yeah. See let's you, let's start with the cover, and then we'll get to whether or not you call yourself a libertarian, a liberal, or an ANCAP or whatever. But so Tomorrow 3.0, the cover. And there'll be an image somewhere on the page, for the Reason Podcast of this. It's a shovel, like a coal shovel. And there's like a bare arm, an arm with a suit jacket, a metal robotic arm, a kind of workman's flannel clad arm. And then it looks like maybe a woman's arm. I don't know. But holding this shovel and they're kind of grabbing at the shovel. What you came up with that cover concept. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And I actually was very pleased with the cover. I was astonished that Cambridge University Press was willing to go with it because, it's a tight ass academic press. And they went along with this.
It was either this or a Durer woodcut, right? Or something like that, if even an image at all.
The final two choices. Yeah, just a black cover with generic sans serif white or this. The idea of the cover was that people can share tools, and we are used to sharing tools metaphorically. Yeah. So I had a variety of people from a variety of different ethnic backgrounds, and then I built that robot arm out of parts that I picked up at Home Depot and spray painted the shovel. It's got the gold glitter paint.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit hokey, but I also hope that it conveys the image that there's really not much reason for us to own many of the things that we own.
Right.
The simple story of the cover is that we can commodify excess capacity. And that's the simple summary of the book is what's going to happen if we commodify excess capacity.
Okay. And that is the sharing economy. We're going to get to that in a second. I want to point out, you say there's different ethnic types. So, let's assume that the robot is actually trans. So there's also multiple sexual orientations here. But it really, you must have grown up in the whitest neighborhood in America, because I'm not seeing a lot of ethnic variation in the skin color on
well,
these arms.
What you're seeing is not a lot of tone, perhaps, different.
Yeah.
But if you were to say that this was a purely white group of people, at least one of them would also be willing to fight. So there's two of us willing to fight you now about this cover.
Okay, so I'm assuming the guy with the flannel-looking shirt is actually Hispanic or something?
The woman on the bottom left is a person of color.
Okay, all right, I'll buy that. Thank you. That's. I think we might be out of time, but, before we talk about the book, do you consider yourself a libertarian, a classical liberal, an anarcho-capitalist, just a regular liberal, a conservative? I don't know, And does that matter?
The answer to the question is longer than it is interesting, so I'll just be brief. I'm a directional libertarian.
Okay, great.
And I've tried to make a distinction between directional and destinationist. I find a lot of destinationist libertarians are anarcho-capitalist. I would get off the train a long time before that. As long as we're going in the wrong direction, though, we can work together.
Okay, so and this is a directional libertarian is like wherever we are now, we want the next stop on this hopefully privately funded and operated conveyance to be closer towards maximum, what, individual freedom, free minds and free markets and reason rubric?
Yeah, I don't know what maximum means. I just want more.
Okay.
Anything that's cheaper and has more freedom and allows people more individual autonomy, I'm for.
Okay, that sounds great. How did you, and now you were incredibly self-deprecating when you said the answer to my designation question is longer than it is interesting, but that was actually pretty interesting. I'm going to, take another risk here by saying, like, how did you come to be the way you are ideologically? And let's have the short version, the abstract.
I was a Republican. I was a part of the Reagan Revolution. I worked in the first Reagan administration for the Federal Trade Commission. We were going to deregulate. We were going to change the world. I found out that many of my Republican colleagues, if you would talk to them, you'd get the idea that they were really for smaller government and limited regulation, lower taxes. But when it came to actually governing, they had trouble with that. So I finally despaired in March of 2003 when in 1 week George W. Bush attacked Iraq. And I had dinner with Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum was visiting Duke, and they said, "Munger, you're a Republican. Go have dinner with him." And I thought, these are just not my people. But then I ran for governor of North Carolina in 2008 as a libertarian candidate, and my education platform was vouchers. So the idea would be that vouchers provided doesn't cost anymore because we're already spending the money. But let's let individuals make choices about where their children go to school using the tax money that we're already collecting. And I was surprised how many libertarians said, no, you can't do that. The state is still involved. So that's when I started to make the directional destinationist distinction. I think vouchers are better than the current state monopoly provision. A lot of libertarians would say, nope, it's not good enough. Forget it. So let's do what we can, and that's why I'm not a destinationist.
And then, of course, at Duke, you've got a couple blocks down from you. On the other side of this equation, you've got Nancy McLean, the author of the book Democracy in Chains, which said that if you're for vouchers, you're like James Buchanan, the Nobel Prize winning economist, and you're just a flat out racist.
Yeah, the vouchers are for her. Just a symbol of segregationism. I'm literally not sure how she makes that argument. I've never met Professor McLean. I would like to. I do have a standing offer to have met her, but it hasn't happened so far.
Yeah, and without getting dragged into that, I mean, it is fascinating because she, when you say you don't know how she gets there, it's true. I mean, you know, especially in light of a lot of criticism of her book, you know, which is part of the kind of review process, really. You know, it seems like there's a lot of bad faith argument going on. It's either bad faith argument or bad scholarship. So, but we'll leave that for now. Yeah,
I tried to give her some credit. This is social history, and she's telling a speculative story. It's plausible. It just happens not to be true.
Right. So, well, speaking of truth and speculation, and hopefully something that's true, there's a seamless pivot. Take that, Baryshnikov, your book is about the sharing economy and, which is the third, you say it's the third great economic revolution. The first two are the Neolithic and the Industrial Revolution. Quickly sketch those out for us. What was big about the Neolithic revolution?
The big switch for the Neolithic was the move from hunter-gatherer society to fixed agriculture and the beginnings of division of labor. It was probably worse for most of the people involved. That is, average height went down, average lifespan went down. The difference was that for the first time, you have enough division of labor, enough increase in the total amount of food and other outputs because everybody specialized in doing something. Hunter-gatherers did everything. Whereas I could be a boot maker, I could be a spear point maker, I could specialize in things.
Well, and that's because agriculture, I mean, it created more food so people could,
dramatically more food.
But then it also created the need for a state or for some kind of government and some type of protection of stored grain because people would come and rob it. I think, were you quoting from Mansur Olson, I think, in the book where you talked about how essentially what, you know, what the agricultural economy did was it internalized piracy and theft because you know, have the government do it rather than roving bands of marauders who may or may not really be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, the way you put it is actually the most optimistic way. You said it created a need for the state. What it did was it created an opportunity for the state because these bandits recognized they could make more by staying in one place and charging tribute rather than going around and robbing people who didn't have much to begin with. So, yeah, Mansur Olson's theory of the stationary as opposed to roving bandit, yes, that is sort of the kind of the origins of the state. The difference, the interesting thing, though, is that it means that you can support 1,000 times as many people on Earth. And so the result is that you get this explosion in human population, and ultimately you get the beginnings of specialization. You get music, you get art, you get literature.
So you get hee-haw, right? I mean, without the agricultural revolution, there's no hee-haw.
Okay, I'm trying to keep a list of the reasons we're going to fight. As a Southerner here and as an admirer of hee-haw, I'm having trouble.
I'm not joking. Hee-haw is one of the great neglected people will be like, oh, Monty Python was so great, or laughing. It's like hee-haw, like, you know, predated and out-survived, outlasted all of these things. And it's actually a damn good show. And I have to say, I think I watched it on WPIX or Channel 5 in the New York viewing area growing up. And it's like I became interested in people like Roy Clark because he was always, you know, finger picking on. Okay, so then we go from the Neolithic to the Industrial Revolution. And what is key about the Industrial Revolution?
The Industrial Revolution is the beginnings of markets. So in the Neolithic, the way to realize cooperation was to do it within a hierarchically organized situation called the city-state, and later maybe a loose confederation of city-states. But the Industrial Revolution meant that you have trade and exchange across city-states where it's not mandated, it's not planned by some central authority, it's just whatever we're able to do in exchange. So you get the beginnings of markets. We'd seen markets in the sense of exchange of primary commodities for a long time, but the Industrial Revolution made it possible through division of labor, through Adam Smith's description of division of labor in a market setting, to again increase by 1,000-fold or more the capacity of the same amount of resources to produce a lot more stuff. And so what we've had since the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, 1760, 1780, an emphasis on wealth and growth being achieved through expanding the amount of stuff that we make and consume and ultimately throw away.
Can I ask, in your kind of in the schema that you're working out there, and this is true of when we get to the sharing economy, which we will in a minute, there's kind of a Marxist dimension of technological determinism, right? Where it's like, you know, agriculture gives us feudalism, you know, the plow gives us feudalism, and then the steam engine, you know, that symbol of the Industrial Revolution, gives us capitalism and kind of liberal political orders. Is that? Am I, and I'm not impugning you with this because your work is also admirably shot through with a lot of Joseph Schumpeter or Schumpeterian analysis. And he certainly, you know, kind of thought in similar ways and credited Marx with that.
Well, sure. What Marx did was pick up something that a Scottish guy, Lord Hames, his name is actually Harry Holme. But he had the four stages of civilization, and Marx basically borrowed that. So this is actually something that comes from the Scottish Enlightenment.
And so that means that he didn't pay full price for it, the Scottish guy?
You're right, because he was Scottish. So that if you're keeping track at home, folks, I think that's that's the fourth or fifth ethnic slur that we've had.
Not ethnic slur, just ethnic observation, ethnic realism, I guess.
He bought it wholesale. He found a way to get it. And Marx was the one who stole it. So
yes,
being a socialist,
Marx was very good at living off of other people's labor, right?
But it is a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
And one of the themes of the book, and it's actually a problem, is that economic revolutions don't care much what we think of them. They happen even if they make many of us worse off, because the logic of an economic revolution is irresistible. And the attempts to resist it may make things worse rather than better. The question is, how can we accommodate what's going to be inevitable? But you're absolutely right in saying that Marx argues that a bunch of things are inevitable, and they may or may not be. It depends how good the theory is.
Well, and in a focused way, I mean, but are you something of a technological determinist or maybe an economic determinist in that economic revolutions or technological revolutions happen whether we want them to or not?
Absolutely.
I did not realize the origins of sabotage until I read this book. And could you for all of the other people out there listening to the Reason podcast who have wondering, why is it called sabotage? Could you explain that very quickly?
Sure. The wooden shoes that were worn by the artisans of northern France and southern Belgium, which was an area that produced a lot of linen, those wooden shoes are called sabot. So S-A-B-O-T, and they were used to do industrial destruction. The artisans were very worried, and understandably, that we were to the inevitability question that you raised, they're very worried about power looms, spinning jennies, the power mules that were taking over their hand loom jobs. And as a result, they threw their wooden shoes and broke these machines. Now, the origins, before you get letters, the origins of the word sabotage are not quite that clean. But it is true that the first saboteurs were the people who threw their wooden shoes into the gears of these new machines and broke them. So sabotage is a thing an attempt to prevent a change or to break machinery. And the question is, in the long run, how much value is it? Can you actually hold back? It isn't progress, but it's change.
Right. And so they're kind of like the continental equivalent of the Luddites, right? Of the Ned Ludd who people... Boy, you know, everybody... What's the problem with cheap clothes? You know, it really gets people upset. But so if the Industrial Revolution was about reducing production costs, I think you kind of say it more or less in those terms at one point... Now we come to the sharing economy or the sharing economy revolution, and that's about reducing transaction costs. Spin out what is packed into that idea of transaction costs and the sharing economy.
Well, first, let me say something that is not obvious until you articulate it, but from the point of view of the consumer, all costs are transactions costs because I'm trying to decide whether to buy this thing or use this thing or not. But from the point of view of the seller, there's some things I have to do in order that I pay to produce the thing. But then there are also costs of effecting the transaction, of actually getting it to the person. So the Industrial Revolution, we've seen many ways of reducing transaction costs, but they were in service of selling stuff. So one of the best examples is the container box, the shipping container, because it was a way of reducing the cost of sending things over a great distance. And as a result, we now buy many things from Asia. The result is that domestic producers were displaced, but that was a way of reducing transactions cost, but for selling stuff. In the new economy, there's three categories of transactions cost, which I made start with TR, so they'll be easier for...
So this is your transaction, your royalty tree. I'm assuming this has something to do with like Dean Smith's, it wouldn't be Dean Smith's, it'd be Coach K's offense or something, but it's triangulation, transfer, and trust. These are your three T's. So why don't you run through those?
Well, triangulation means we have to be able to find each other. Transfer means that we have to agree on a price and you get the stuff and I get the money. And trust means that we have to believe that each is not going to rob the other. And what's interesting in once you realize that to the consumer, everything is a transaction cost, then I, as an entrepreneur, I don't even need to sell products anymore. All I need to do is sell reductions in one of those three categories. And if I can sell reductions in transactions costs through this pretty innocuous thing called software in the form of an app that I can download and put on my phone, for the first time in human history, people are able to specialize just in selling reductions in transactions costs. And what that enables is peer-to-peer sales. Instead of somebody making something and somebody else buying it, I can be a consumer and you can be a consumer because we can commodify the excess capacity. I'm not using all of this thing that I have. Mm-hmm. I can sell part of it to you. Now, we have a word for that. It's called renting. But renting understates the sort of significance of selling reductions in transactions costs that allow peer-to-peer cooperation.
So to bring it back to that hideous, god-awful cover, you've got the
that
shovel.
That is the best cover.
You've got five people, well, actually four people and one robot squeezing the handle on the shovel. You know, the idea is that there's a shovel there and nobody's going to be using it all day. So, you know, what the sharing economy allows is for that shovel to be in the grip of whoever needs it at a particular moment.
Right. And when you say it that way, it sounds like, well, it's going to be really hard for us to coordinate this because when am I going to use it and when are right. you going to use it? But the important thing is, how often do you actually use the shovel that you have in your garage? Once every two or three months.
Oh, if you're lucky. And then, you know, it's like at half the time I can't find it. So I go out and buy a new one because yep. I'm like, oh, that goddamn shoveler. Then I realize, oh, I hit it over a stump and broke it the yep. last time I pulled it out.
Well, in my case, one of my sons borrows it and I'm not sure where it is. If it were possible, I mean, when you think about it, when I go through my suburban neighborhood, the houses are pretty close together. Most of them are on 1-acre lots, but everybody has their own lawnmower. And a lot of them are yeah. pretty big, nice riding lawnmowers. It takes about 45 minutes to mow the lawn once every 10 days. And each of us has our own lawnmower that we store. Why don't we share these things? And the answer is transactions cost.
Right.
Because I can't necessarily find, I can't do the triangulation. I don't know when it's going to be. It's hard for me to pick it up and use it. And I don't trust you not to break it. And so I buy my own.
So but do you as an economist driving around and then also riding the lawnmower, like you must be crying all of the time, realizing that everybody has their own lawnmower when really you could get by just with like one that you shared.
Well,
it must
I guess,
be very difficult to be you, Michael Munger.
It's very difficult to be my wife. But we could get, but it's wonderful to be me because
yeah.
I see all of these as opportunities. Yeah. Everything that we can think of that's a problem is an opportunity for some entrepreneur.
Oh my God, this is like, did you go to the Dale? You must have gone to Dale Carnegie University, not Carnegie Mellon or something. You just see acres of diamonds out there.
If you just walk around someone's house, there's closets, there's cabinets yeah. full of crap. Yeah. People have a bread maker, they have a sausage maker. There is no reason for us to own any of those things if we can yeah. rent them. We're on the verge of a golden age. We're going to have smaller houses that have more usable space in them. It's a total win-win.
Okay. Yeah, except for the I'm not going to get off target now. So we all know the, you know, kind of Uber and Airbnb are kind of considered avatars, if that's the right word, or I guess so. It's what was the Silver Surfer was the what of he was like the emissary of Galactus in the Fantastic Four. I'm sorry. I'm losing. I'm in a room in order to record this podcast. I'm becoming a little confessional here. I turn off the air conditioner and the fan. And I'm in a room that's like 100 degrees now. So I'm starting to lose it. But Uber and Airbnb are probably the best known instantiations of the sharing economy because, like you say, you know, they make it easier for you to, you know, somebody has a car, you need a ride, they get together. Same thing with a house and excess capacity where somebody has a room or a bed or a couch or an apartment that they can put together. But then you also talk about how Amazon is actually part of the sharing economy in ways that I don't think I didn't fully appreciate until I read in your book. And talk a little bit about that, because that also one of the things that I'm interested in hearing about is like, OK, yeah, so Uber, Airbnb, we get it, the sharing economy. What's next? But you talk about Amazon and how Amazon is actually part in this deal of you know, reducing transaction costs. And I'm going to insist on calling it transaction. You call it transactions costs, right?
Well, not in the book. I say that verbally. That's just a mistake. So let us, anytime I say transactions, you are right that I am wrong to say that. It's just a bad habit.
I assume that you are, you know, you're the economist. So
That's true,
and
but
the political
I'm also
scientist.
Wrong about this.
Okay, so you have that Hayekian, well, he talked about epistemological humility, but you have pronunciatory humility.
Yeah, I think I'm just wrong. And if that's what causes the humility, then fair enough. Well, when you think about it, it's odd that groups of sellers want to be in the same place. But 5,000 years ago, the souk in Aleppo was one of the oldest marketplaces in the world. And the reason that all these sellers wanted to be in the same place was that made it easier for buyers to find them. The Sears catalog is, they didn't actually sell stuff. All they did was said, we will sell you space to advertise your product. We will sell a way of shipping the product, and we will collect the money for you. And you can trust us because people know the Sears brand name. So they solved the three problems: triangulation, transfer, and trust. So Amazon, when it first started, and people remember this, but I'm not sure that millennials now will know it. Amazon was a
millennials.
Bookstore.
Yeah,
it was a bookstore.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Amazon's not a bookstore. What Amazon does now is sell reductions in triangulation, transfer, and trust costs, because Amazon makes almost all of its money from a suite of software called Amazon Web Services, AWS. Yeah. So what Amazon discovered was that the value proposition was people would go to Amazon and then they would search for products. So the more products that Amazon could list, you could find them. Amazon has a way of charging for them. So we have transfer. They have a way of shipping them. And Amazon has a way of saying that if you want to return it, they'll help you. So they solve the trust problem.
Yeah, you point out at one point that Amazon sale, and this is an actual quote, Amazon sale of physical goods has never made a profit. The way they make profit is by reducing, they don't make it up on volume. They make it up by lowering transaction costs.
Yes.
Yeah,
and I think actually in the last year or so, they have started to break even. And in some sectors, once they get the bricks and mortar stores, they're able to make. But almost also 90% of their profits still are just selling reductions in transactions costs. So what I think is interesting about that is Amazon is using that new model of basically being an app to sell reductions in transactions costs, but they're selling things to be owned. So I think that when people ask about Uber and you ask what entity is it that Uber is most dangerous to, people would say, oh, it's taxi companies. That's not right. No more than Amazon was dangerous to bookstores, though it was. Mm-hmm. What Uber is actually a danger to is Amazon, because Uber is also able to sell those three things. Once, if I go on to Uber, there's no reason that, like Amazon, they can't list all sorts of products, but to rent, not own.
And they're already, well, I guess not to rent, but they are, Uber is selling food now delivery services. But what you're saying is that the ultimate distinction here is going to be between selling or like bringing people together to pay for stuff to own or stuff to rent.
Yes, right. And so the only reason that you own stuff, you own durable products and you pay to store it, is that it's too expensive to rent. If I could rent, like the example of the power drill that you talked about at the beginning, there's so many things that I wouldn't need to own, I could rent instead. Now, I admit the example of the drill is a bit too far, and that's a drill joke because it has a bit.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Thank you. But the...
That is so terrible, it should be on the cover of your book, Tomorrow 3.0.
No, there's already something terrible on the cover, as you pointed out. But there are several new companies that are now... When I picked the drill, I thought, I'm going to pick something that won't be possible for 10 years. Hmm. But right now, there are companies, several companies, that where you can rent tools, and I can rent them from someone in my neighborhood that has the tool but isn't using it right now. And so if you had an Uber driver that could go pick it up, bring it to me, and then another Uber driver, didn't have to wait, another Uber driver picks it up when I'm done, and the software handles all of that, then Uber could specialize in rental deliveries.
So what is the, let me just ask before we move off of this for a second, though, but then who owns the drill, though, that's getting passed around? Like, and where is the incentive to create the drill? Does the owner make more because they own the drill?
Well, the short answer is yes. In medieval times, a lot of people might own one asset that they would either rent out or let other mm-hmm. people use and have a sharing arrangement where, you know, reciprocally, you'll let me use a tool if I can use one of your tools. So right. it's a kind of okay. tool library. And in fact, there's a lot of places that are like that. But someone also might specialize in having a store that only provides these rentals. And you ask who has an incentive to make them. I think that's going to change. There's, as I say in the book, there's 110 million power drills in the United States. The median use is half an hour, lifetime.
So I was going to say, I think literally four of them are sitting 25 feet away from me in my garage, and I can never find them when I need them. So, yeah.
But you have them. Suppose yeah. that instead it was possible to rent a, and I don't mean to talk bad about your drills. I know you're very sensitive about your drills, but you could rent a commercial quality drill that's better than any yeah. of the sorry little drills that you have and send it back and pay $2.50. And that would mean that we would need 6 or 7 million high quality commercial power drills. The density of use would be, so when the Uber driver picks it up from me, she doesn't take it back to the hardware store, she takes it to the next user because people are using these drills constantly. So we wouldn't be storing them. We would use them up faster, but they would be built to last longer because they're commercial rental quality. That really brings us to a significant problem because you are the Segway Meister. If we only need 6 million commercial yeah. quality power drills that are built to last a long time, who's going to make the drills? Who has the incentive to make these things?
So if I may, in my list of questions here, and I didn't expect it to flow this nicely, I literally have written down, so far, things have been mostly roses and rainbows. But to your credit and the book's great interest, you don't stint on the destructive elements of this creative destruction. So continue, Professor Munger. suddenly, you know, if you're Stanley Tools or John Deere or whoever makes power tools, Snap-on.
Yeah, Black & Decker.
Is Snap-on still around? I don't know. You know? But yeah, like it's one thing if you can sell 110 million. It's another thing if you're selling 6 million. So what happens? Who's making the drills?
Somebody will still specialize in making the high-quality drills. There will be far, far fewer of them. And economists, being clever and actually physically attractive also, but mostly clever, we economists have a way of summarizing the value of what workers get paid, and it's called real wages. Real wages are the ratio of the nominal wage, which is what it says on your paycheck, to the price level. And so what I've argued is two things. One is that prices are going to plummet because we will systematically be able to rent instead of own. The other thing that's going to happen, though, is wages are going to fall. And in fact, many traditional jobs may disappear altogether because we're not going to make anything like the same amount of stuff. This is not, it'll be made in China instead. It's not going to be made anywhere because we'll need far less. Mm-hmm. That's a great thing for the environment. It means that we can have bike paths instead of parking spaces because there will not be all these cars that we pay to store because we're able pretty seamlessly to rent. The question is, there's two questions. One is, overall, are real wages going to go up or down? And then what's the distribution of that thing?
Right. Meaning well, and can I ask, I mean, this is, yeah, too, because I'm slower on the uptake than you. This, so part of the transition to this sharing economy, which, as you point out, we're already in, you know, we're partway through. We don't know maybe how it ends or, but, you know, suddenly we, in a world where, you don't need to own a car because you can just call one and it'll show up. That's a lot of jobs that disappear too, right?
Well, and truck drivers, trucks in particular, long-haul trucking will be entirely done by software. So the big problem that we have is that software is going to eat the world. Mark Andreessen famously said software eats the world. And you're seeing this already in fast food restaurants. All you have to do is turn the cash register around. Instead of me looking at a board and mumbling some words and the guy finding the same words on the keyboard, just turn the cash register around. And that I can press the keys.
This explains why the checkout cashiers at Kroger look over at the people doing the self-checkout with so much anger, and their fists are clenching and unclenching because it's like, God, they figured it out. It's really not that difficult.
In 5 years, many of those jobs are going to be gone. So software is going to replace so many of the service jobs that we complain about now.
Yeah, that and of course, then we'll eulogize those jobs. Wasn't it? Did you remember when we were burger flippers together? That was so exciting and so vibrant, and we had a job that really meant something. I guess this is part of the question then of like, do wages, will they fall in a way that people will be poorer, or will they, prices will be so much cheaper? I mean, what is your sense of, are people going to be better off, the average worker? Or I guess part of your point is that there's not really going to be, to talk about an average worker or a median worker is not really going to do us much good in this new economy.
Well, we have to think about that. What's going to happen overall? And then what is the distribution of effects?
Mm-hmm.
So first, I think overall, many people, if you can think of any source of income that's systematic, you may work a 2-day work week, or you may work gigs if you have a particular skill. And we already see the so-called gig economy working very well in Hollywood, because there's a bunch of different disciplines that go into making a movie. I just put myself on LinkedIn. So I get a phone call saying, we're going to shoot a movie. I have a pretty good job for 6 weeks. I get paid quite a bit. And then the production company that was making that movie, it just breaks up because the movie's done. And then we form again in a new team. People look on LinkedIn. They call the 170 different, the gaffer, the key grip, the best boy. I think you could have been the best boy, Nick.
I would like to, especially if it's a porn. But, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Thanks for going there for me.
Yeah.
All of these different disciplines, I don't know what they are, but I don't really need to, because if I hire all of those, we make the movie, they split back up. So traditional firms don't exist, long-term jobs don't exist. But if I work 6 weeks a year, that may be enough to be able to, if I can rent everything and I have to have a much smaller house, housing will be cheaper because we won't need as much storage. People who can take advantage of positioning themselves there where they are their own brand in the gig economy, they will do better. It will be a golden age. They won't have to work very much.
And you talk about this in the book as less job versus no job. So you're not worried in terms of the automation stuff. You're not worried about everything going away, as some people are. But it's going to be a lot less. And now I'm thinking, back to the 2016 presidential race, and particularly in the, when the Democrats were still figuring out who they were going to nominate. Both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders explicitly came out against the gig economy for some of the reasons you're kind of laying out, that it's like, what happens when everything becomes cheaper, so does labor. People are making less money and they got to cobble together an existence. None of these firms exist, so there's no, you're not going to get health care from your employer or retirement or any kind of benefits and things like that. Is that... I realize we're in the midst of something, but is that a kind of terrifying, vision of at least the near future, where you got to hustle and hustle and hustle, and you're making less and less money?
Well, you are making less and less money, but if things cost less also, then that may be an improvement.
Right.
It is still, the transition is terrifying. The reason that Karl Marx wrote in 1848 the Communist Manifesto is that many of the cities of Europe were on fire, not metaphorically, not Oder's fire. Literally, there were riots and the cities were on fire. I think we may face something like the same thing because it's very difficult for people not to fetishize jobs. Now, the idea of a job is maybe 250 years old, but that's long enough that people have come to define themselves, their ability to provide for their families, and their sense of position in society. If you're at a cocktail party, people, they might ask about where you're from, but they're probably going to say, what is your job? What is it that you do? That's a big part of our self-definition. If we start to lose that, then that's going to be a wrenching change. Here's the thing. When you talk about benefits or when you talk about minimum wages, the things that we might reflexively try to do to solve this problem, it only makes the transition happen faster because it increases the differential gain from going to software instead of having the job. If I have a minimum wage, I switch to software faster. If I have to pay benefits, I switch to software faster. So the sort of paroxysms that you're talking about, where Bernie Sanders says, oh, we're going to get rid of this, are going to have the opposite effect. They're going to make it worse.
So is that, can I question whether or not McDonald's and, you know, they're rolling out the automated kiosk all over America now, which had been in place, I guess, in parts of Asia or Japan and certainly Europe for quite a while. Is automation generally, I mean, basically, or let me put it this way, when you're going to automate first where labor costs are highest.
Yes.
Generally. Yeah. And yes. So that, you know, if you pass a $15 minimum wage law or $20 minimum wage law, basically what you're arguing is that you're going to speed up the transition to robots.
Right.
In the name of stopping the automation of a workplace.
Well, they're not trying to stop the automation. What they're trying to do is providing a living wage for the people who have jobs. And the paradox is having a higher wage in the job that no longer exists doesn't help anybody.
Right. So that is, you know, that's the key employment change that, you know, software eats the world. We're going to a gig economy. Let me ask you, how do you see that playing out? You're in one of the last true guild professions where, you know, you're a university professor, you get life tenure or something close to it. That system does seem to be breaking down. But how is this going to change higher education?
Well, it is interesting to ask about higher education. A lot of people ask me if I'm worried about being replaced by videos. Maybe I will be. But when you look around in New York, there are some places where within a few blocks, there's a movie theater and an actual theater where you can see a live play. Now, the quality of the live plays has to be pretty high. So what higher education might move to is a system where we have in the elite schools, we'll still specialize in kind of personal contact. And for many schools and for remote areas, we'll do it much more either through the internet or over videos. And it's not clear to me that that won't be an improvement. It'll certainly be a lot cheaper.
Right.
So although it's easy for me to say, I'm a tenured professor at an elite school. So of course, I'm going to be satisfied with the existing system. I think there is going to be a wrenching change in higher education, and much of it will be for the better to the extent that we can do things, we can realize some of the economies of scale that come from being able to use videos and automated testing. Probably there's a lot of expense and redundant excess capacity in education that we haven't made very good use of. But I think all of these things are going to continue to happen at once.
So there's, you know, falling prices, rising levels of kind of ubiquitous goods and services that are cheaper. It has an effect on income, or rather on employment. And then in the book, you do talk about, you know, besides the transition costs and the wrenchingness of this, both in the labor market, it's also rising income disparity in our economy. Is that a function of this, or is it just kind of a parallel development?
Well, I think it's going to be a function in the sense that having some kind of specialized skill is going to be necessary to have employment, because something that you can contribute where other people can recognize that particular skill and find you to do it. Now, we'll still need gardeners, we'll still need all sorts of things that, so this isn't so much robotics as being replaced by software. It's also possible, and I mentioned this in the book, what we could have is a reduction in transactions costs that return us to a kind of golden age of artisan specialization. Suppose that I could make really good cheese, or I could make really good pickles. And right now, people don't know about it, and they're not going to drive to a little tiny store in order to pick it up because it's expensive to park. But right now, there are bearded young men and bearded young women who live in Brooklyn, New York, who are laboring to make maple, bacon, garlic pickles for $17 for a little jar. And I go online. I live, let's say, in the Lower East Side. I'm not going to go across the bridge to get these, but I go online and I ask to have these delivered. And the next day, an Uber delivers my pickles. I have great pickles. My friends have these and they say, wow, where did you get these? So it may be that people specializing in the sort of things that 300 years ago we specialized in. Even when I was growing up, milk, bread, cheese, those things were delivered to our house. We stopped doing that and we went to what's actually a pretty expensive way of getting food, where you have to drive to a grocery store, you have to park, you go in, you put these things in bags, you go to the checkout counter, you go back home, you unpack it. If you could skip all of those things and just be able to order them online and have them delivered, then a lot of the reduction in cost would make a lot of artisanal production possible. So maybe I'm wrong, and we're going to enter a new golden age of people making really interesting things on small scale, because the cost of buying them will be so much less.
But there will be income disparities, and you're worried about that. And this may be more of your political scientist hat. And it's interesting, you were, if I'm remembering correctly, Michael, you were trained as an economist, but you've been hired or worked in political science departments.
Yeah, I was trained as an economist, and I worked at the Federal Trade Commission. And I taught economics at Dartmouth. But for the past 30 years, I've been in political science departments. Right. So I actually am persuaded that we need some form of universal basic income to reduce the sort of sense of exposure that people have to the uncertainty of
here,
the new economy.
For, because we're, you know, we're good libertarians, you know, at least directional we're in the church of directional libertarianism as opposed to the destinationists who, you know, the only thing I can tell you is that they're the only thing worse than the destinationists are the Catholics. But, you know, there's rising income disparities. Why is that a problem? Because this is something that you hear a lot in libertarian circles, you know, that, well, income disparity isn't a problem, you know, because as long as things are getting better.
Well, but as we talked about, saying things are getting better or things that are inevitable are not is not the same as saying those people who, through no fault of their own, went to high school and then tried to find a job and weren't able to find a job, that is, they're playing by the rules of the old system, become unhappy. I think there's three arguments for something like a universal basic income. Okay. One is, if you look at the amount that we're spending.
Before we get there, can I ask, is it clear that there is actual income disparity that exists through time? So it's not simply that at any given moment, you know, the 1% is making 90% of the, you know, the money, and that the 90% are making, you know, 10% of the money. Is this a question where long time, you know, over time, certain people who are going to be the same people are going to be much, much wealthier? There's not income mobility. There's not anything like that. So that income disparity is absolutely real, absolutely growing, and kind of insoluble.
The answer to that question takes about 30 minutes.
Let me see if I'll
try it in one.
And if you can't do it, I'm gonna tap, you know, bring me an answer on my phone, and you know, something's gonna be here for $2.50.
So. It'll be there in no time. Well, suppose I take a snapshot of an intersection, and if you look, the light is red one direction and green the other. That seems completely unfair. Those people are being stopped. But if you look over a little bit longer time, sometimes it's red, sometimes it's green. The system is dynamic. Not everybody gets to go all the time. The income system in some ways is like that. So if you look at the top 1%, the top 10%, a lot of those people weren't there 5 years ago. A fair number of people from the middle class, at least, have been able to move up. Some of the people who are wealthy have moved down. There's a lot of churn in the income distribution. So if you just look at like the top 20% and the bottom 20%, well, there's always going to be a bottom 20% because you're just defining that as the one-fifth of the population that has the least money. It's not the same people over time. I'm worried that the perception is that it is increasingly the same people over time. And it's actually true that in the U.S., the degree of social mobility, where the very poorest become, it, like in the top third, where your children are much better off than you are, it doesn't happen as much as it used to. I think the dynamism of the system is we underestimate it because we often take that snapshot like looking at the stoplight. The stoplight, I think, is a good way to think of it because it does change. Sometimes it's red, sometimes it's green. You can't just look at one snapshot and infer that there's that much inequality.
So is this more of a perception thing? Because as say people like Scott Winship at the Manhattan Institute and others say that income mobility since the early 70s has really not slowed down. It's not as big as many of us would like, but it's basically the same. Are you saying it is actually slowing down?
Well, I think it has slowed down slightly. Mm-hmm. The U.S. used to be maybe I would put it this way. It used to be that in the U.S., our degree of income mobility was as high as any in the world. And now, for a variety of reasons, it's not really much different than a lot of parts of Europe. Mm-hmm. We're missing a lot of the very poorest people in terms of education or a sense of inclusion in the larger society. Mm-hmm. But remember, I'm a directionalist. I'm not that concerned with ultimate arguments about whether poverty programs are justified. What I'm doing is looking at existing poverty programs. We're spending an enormous amount when you add everything up, including minimum wage laws, which have the problem of preventing people from finding their first job and getting experience. So if you take Social Security, minimum wage, Section 8 housing subsidies, and all of the various subsidies that we give for food or care for children, and you add it all up and divide by the number of poor people, there shouldn't be any poor people. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we're not giving them the money. And so one of the things that I think basic income does is smoke out the basic paternalism of many people, because they'll say, oh, you can't give them the money. You know how they are.
Right.
They'll just spend it on the wrong things. Well, no, I don't know how they are. I actually think that many people face a benefits cliff, in the sense that the first $10,000 I earn, if I get a job, I lose $12,000 in benefits. So the poor are not lazy. The poor are rational. They're not going to get a job for $10,000 and they lose $12,000 in benefits. So we need to get rid of that benefits cliff somehow. We need to make it possible for people to start to take the stair steps towards the American dream and increase social mobility. That, to me, is the attraction of basic income, is take the money we're spending already on poverty programs, but actually give it to people and not make it contingent on them continuing to be poor.
I think that, you know, increasingly the American dream is to move to Canada. But I think so is this why you talk about it as a basic income guarantee as opposed to a universal basic income? And I don't know if I'm reading too much into your words, but the idea is not that, you know, one of the problems when people start talking about a universal basic income is that it goes to everybody, regardless of, you know, whatever else they have. And it gets very expensive. And it also seems kind of stupid to give a millionaire, you know, an extra, you know, 15 grand a year just for being alive. But so a basic income guarantee, part of it is that you would take this amount of money that we're spending on helper programs or social welfare programs and just give it to the people who, like, I mean, it would top off people making very little money.
Yes. And the way that I would do that is it's basically Milton Friedman's or Charles Murray's mm-hmm. negative income tax. Mm-hmm. So that you've got a standard deduction, I think now it's 7,000. So the first 7,000 that you earn is not taxed. And if you're on your 1040 form, you put that down. So let's instead make that 22,000. And if you make less than that, you get a credit. But for the millionaire, they have a $22,000 standard deduction. Mm-hmm. We'd have to change tax rates a little bit so that it's revenue neutral. That is, the millionaire on net wouldn't receive anything extra, but the people who don't have any income would receive the full amount. Mm. I actually think that would increase, and I may be wrong about this, but right now a lot of poor people face what economists call a price effect. That is, if they get a job, they lose almost the same amount of money. And so in terms of mm-hmm. prices, it makes no sense for them to do that.
So, the only reason to do it is because you say, okay, I'm going to take this hit now because I might be better off 5 or 10 years down the road. It's one of the reasons why, you know, people will take low paying first jobs, you know, that have more of a future rather than a higher paying job that will top out very quickly.
Right. But if you're right up against it and you don't have enough money to live, you can't afford to have that longer term view. Alternatively, suppose that I'm wrong. There's going to be an income effect because I will get money even if I don't work. And so I can quit my job at Starbucks and live in my parents' basement and play RuneScape all the time and be a level 60 character with the most badass kind of armor. And there, I'll have a bunch of 15-year-old fanboys in South Korea.
Save it, for your therapist, your family therapist with your kids, okay? I get it. I think everybody with kids gets it. No, but so what about the recent experiments in universal basic or guaranteed incomes? Are they Finland, I guess, is thrown in the towel, right, on their attempt to provide some sort of minimum income?
Yeah, it's such an interesting example. Finland was worried about the rate of growth of their economy. And so they decided that they would have a Keynesian policy of putting a lot of money in the hands of people and hoping that that would increase GDP. And it turns out that it didn't. So it was a purely Keynesian experiment. They weren't looking to see if it benefited poverty. They wanted to see if it increased the growth rate of the economy, and it didn't. But that's not my objective anyway. My objective is to try to solve the problem of poverty. And in a way, if you give people money, it's bound to solve the problem of poverty.
Or at least redefine it upwards,
That experiment isn't really relevant, but it is true that it turned out to be very expensive, and their objective, which was to increase economic growth, didn't pan out.
What speaking of economic growth, you know, one of the weird things, and again, you know, you were talking about millennials who might not remember what Amazon was in the 90s when it started. You know, they also, millennials sadly don't remember economic growth, you know, above 2% annually a year. We grew up and we're roughly the same age. We're in our, you know, late 20s. But, you know, where average income, annual income, economic growth in America post-World War II or since 1950 has been what, around like 3.2% or a little bit higher than 3%?
And sometimes it would be 4 or 5 after a recession. Right. So you can sort of you catch up.
Yeah. But in the 21st century, it's basically been below 2%. And does that factor into this at all? Is the software eating economic growth, even if it is kind of reducing prices?
Well, sure. And the reason is that what you're talking about is measure of GDP growth. And GDP is the amount of stuff that you're selling times the price at which you're selling it. And it just means that GDP is an archaic concept and we should throw it away. The price that I pay to be on Facebook or Twitter or to use Wikipedia is zero. But that doesn't mean it has no value. So all of the things that software provides for free, all the things that the new economy provides at a very low price, is going to say that if we look at the rate of growth of GDP, it's going to plummet. But the actual value received by consumers is going to skyrocket. So the GDP growth, it's true, is either going to be flat or it may even fall. But the question is, what new measures are we going to use to look at the benefit to consumers and users of all these things that are free or nearly free?
And this goes back to kind of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and actually Donald Trump, too, who's no big fan of the sharing economy, it seems, or kind of modern economic concepts. He doesn't use email, things like that. The politics of this is that in order to stave off something that's happening, people are going to have recourse because they're saying there's a crisis based on archaic measures, and then they're going like GDP, and they're going to use archaic measures like minimum wage laws and other types of regulations that only kind of speed up the change. This is a long wind up to ask, what are the politics or the political economy of getting clearly our poverty alleviation programs aren't working because every year we have the bottom 20%, you know, there's 20% of people who are making the lowest 20% or something like that. How do you get to sell saying let's get rid of these specialized vouchers and coupons, most of which don't really make it to the person they're intended for, and replace that with an unrestricted cash transfer, which seems to be what you're talking about.
It's absolutely what I'm talking about, and you have raised absolutely the most difficult problem. It's not an accident that we have the system that we have. There are people on the left who really want to help the poor. There are people on the right that say, okay, but I want to make sure that they're the deserving poor, and so we're going to add all of these conditions. When you put the two things together, it means that the system is really expensive and largely ineffectual. It locks people into a permanent sort of chain of poverty. But it's very difficult to change either of those two positions. Politically, I'm not sure how we do it, but that's why I try to write books and convince people that there at least could be a better way.
So here you're hauling out the division of labor in order to say you've got no goddamn idea how to take this across the finish line, right?
Yeah, right.
You're an ideas guy.
Yeah.
I get it. Okay.
I actually ran for governor. It didn't go very well. I tried the other things.
You did well, though, for a libertarian, didn't you, in your run?
Sure. My goal was to get 2.2%, and I got 2.8%, which means that if you define your goals really low, you can be a success.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the as long as the soft bigotry of expectation of low expectations is self-generated and not a societal construct, I think that's pretty good. No, but that still is actually a pretty impressive total for a third party.
I learned a lot from doing it. I'm glad I did. Yeah. I was included in four debates with the real candidates, which was not something that had happened before. But you do learn something about trying to sell these ideas. And I think we as libertarians need to do a better job of communicating not just what our objectives are, but the reasons why, and also what is our positive, optimistic vision of the future that people should flock to instead of, you know, all we can promise is we're going to do nothing for you. What is it that we can say that here's the reason? So here's the reason why you should follow this, because the world is going to be better.
Right. And, you know, by the way, I neglected to bring this up earlier. One of the things that I really liked about the book and your work in general is that you recover the idea of capitalism, you know, more or less, which is obviously not the term that Adam Smith used or capitalist used, but that it's actually a system of cooperation, first and foremost, more than, you know, it isn't this sometimes. You read people who libertarians or market enthusiasts who talk about how great it is because this competition squeezes out every, every drop of inefficiency, and it makes people, you know, go bankrupt, and it there's winners and losers. And what you actually are talking about a lot is that, you know, it's a cooperative system that allows people who otherwise have no understanding or no knowledge or interest or love for one another to kind of get along in a really good, productive way.
And so we have mutual interdependence on a scale that would have been unimaginable without a market system and capitalism. So, yes, I think it's a mistake to emphasize greed and competition, whereas what capitalism really does is encourage sharing and cooperation.
Well, we are going to leave it there, Michael Munger, Michael C. Munger. Michael, thanks for talking with the Reason podcast.
Oh, it was great to talk to you, and we're still going to fight about the cover.
Oh, absolutely. We have been talking with Michael C. Munger. He's a Duke professor of political science, trained as an economist. He is the author of the new Cambridge University book, Tomorrow 3.0, Transaction Costs and the Sharing Economy. This has been the Reason Podcast. I have been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and rate us. Rate and review us while you're there. Thank you for listening.